Well, when the first settlers arrived here, they brought their own food with them, including the sugar and flour that was to prove so deadly to Aboriginal people. They took absolutely no notice of the foods that the locals had eaten for millennia, and in fact deliberately ignored them, something author John Newton calls cultural racism. In his book, The Oldest Foods on Earth, he argues that dismissing Australian native foods was all part of the terra nullius doctrine, that there was no local culture to displace, just nomadic groups of hunter-gatherers. And, he told me, this scornful attitude to Indigenous food is really only just starting to change.
This, what I called food racism, lasted right up till very recently. And the story I tell in the book, which shocked me when I heard it, is from the 1990s. Raymond Kirsch, a wonderful European exponent of using native produce in his cuisine, in restaurants, in several restaurants called Edna's Table, when he first put the names of those ingredients, those Indigenous ingredients, on the menu, one of his old customers came up to him very angrily and said, "Raymond, why are you using this Abbo shit?" I mean, that was horrifying to me. But when I began to contemplate it, I thought, well, that just shows you the cultural power of food. The people would be so angry about using fairly innocuous ingredients in a menu, and he wasn't the only one. Several of their old customers fell off when they began to proudly extol their use of native produce.
We live in a society now that's completely obsessed with food.
Yeah.
And in your book, you note that thing about superfoods. You know, some people are eating blueberries every day, and there's a list of 10 superfoods. But what you point out is that some of the really, really superfoods have been here the whole time under our noses.
Well, they have, and they are. And we are beginning to recognise that. And terrific scientists like Isabella Konjac, from who worked at CSIRO and RIRD, a Rural Industries Research Development Corporation, who I interviewed for the book, has been analysing these foods and finding extraordinary levels of antioxidants and vitamin C and all sorts of things, lutein, all the things that we need, they're all in these foods. They're in there because they've had to survive over such a long time through varying climates. I mean, the Australian climate has changed enormously over the eons that the country has been here. It's just about the oldest country on earth. And those foods have survived for that reason. And now we're just beginning to realise that. And we're beginning to look at them more closely and to cultivate them.
How much cultivation is going on around Australia? How available are these things to the average shopper?
There are people, the Quambies, who have a nursery at Reedy Creek. They've been doing it for some time now. There are many others up and down the coast, but there's not enough critical mass to start to see these things appearing in their raw forms on the supermarket shelves. And there are many, many issues around this too. You know, there are issues of provenance, there are issues of ownership, there are issues of who owns these foods.
You end your book by telling a couple of tales that really highlight the difference between how America was settled in terms of engagement with the locals and how Australia was settled. It's the first meal, the first shared meal in each place. Can you tell
those
stories?
That is a fascinating contrast. In America, the Thanksgiving feast at the end of the first crop in 1621, there was a meal between the pilgrims and the Native Americans who'd helped them with their cropping of corn. And they sat down together at table and they ate a meal which was a mixture of the foods they had brought from Europe and the foods that they had found in the New World, like corn, like cranberries. And at the centre of the table was the turkey, which has become emblematic of not just of the Thanksgiving, but of America in many ways. The turkey is a very important animal. So that happened, and they were invited to the table and they sat together and they ate together. By contrast, the first meal that any Indigenous person ate with the first Fleet people was, he was dragged there against his will. Philip was told to have intercourse with the native people and to be, you know, to talk to them and to endeavour, in the words of the order from King George III, by every possible means to open an intercourse with natives and to conciliate their affections. So Philip decided what he would do is he would kidnap some and take them to dinner. They all got away except for one bloke called Arabanu. And Arabanu was tied with ropes and he was sent to the government house where he was set at a side table and he was fed. He ate the meal. He didn't want to eat the liquor. He didn't want to eat the bread, but he ate the meat and the fish. The only thing he did wrong was at the end of the meal, he threw a plate out the window, as he would have with a leaf upon which a meal had been served. So the contrast is very stark. A meal at which the local people were invited and which was shared, and a meal at which the only local person who they could get to come, they had to tie in ropes and drag him to the table.
And it leads you to an idea for Australia Day, the debate about which is revving up every year about how we should celebrate Australia Day. Tell us that idea.
Well, whatever we call it, perhaps we could have a day where Indigenous Australians and white Australians get together, and this could be professional cooks or family cooks, cook a meal together using a mixture of European and Australian native produce, and sit at the table and eat together, because eating together is a pretty good way of getting over differences.
That's John Newton, who's written a book called The Oldest Foods on Earth, A History of Australian Native Foods with Recipes. That's published by New South Books.